Hey, thanks for joining me on the Wine Road today. For this podcast, I'd love to take you to France, but since that would be much too complicated, I'll do the next best thing here in the U.S. Ride along with me to Jordan Vineyard and Winery in Alexander Valley, Sonoma County, California.
We're always trying to raise the bar because for us, wine is not just a beverage. It's not just some fermented grape juice and some glass. It's an experience.
We really started identifying ourselves palate-wise with our wine with Burgundy. And I love the Pouligny because it's so seductive, you know, it's not powerful.
It was an extreme pleasure to spend a couple of hours interviewing CEO John Jordan and winemaker Rob Davis at Jordan. Although they were recorded back to back, they're two different types of interviews. John was a typical Q&A, and with Rob, it was more of a conversation. Jordan is an ivy-covered icon. It's one of Sonoma County's most stunning wineries, fashioned after a French chateau. It stands boldly yet gracefully among the sweeping lawn, beautiful manicured trees, and recently planted vineyard. Since they produced their first vintage in 1976, their wine has lived up to the elegance of the chateau. And by the way, winemaker Rob Davis has crafted every bottle of wine since their inaugural vintage of 76. That's astounding. But I'll start with John and the topic of his parents' Epiphany wine that I read about. Except the 1966 Napa Valley Beaulieu Vineyard George Latour that prompted the aha moment for Tom and Sally Jordan wasn't necessarily about the wine. They'd already become connoisseurs. It was realizing that they can plant a vineyard, build a winery, and make exceptional wine in California. But, as John points out, the story goes back further.
Well, actually, my parents became food lovers before they became wine lovers. As young people in the 50s, they would save their pennies and they would travel to France. And they would enjoy some of the French cuisine that you couldn't get in Colorado in that, at that time. Now the restaurant scene in Denver is very different. But they would go and they become lovers of French food first. And of course, you can't become a lover of French food, of course, without being introduced to French wine. And that's where my parents' love affair with wine began. And that's why it became a focal point of their lives from that point forward. But at that point, all of the great wines, the Bordeaux varietals, were indigenous and only existed in France, or so they thought. And so then they traveled to San Francisco and then went to a restaurant called Ernie's, a longtime San Francisco staple, and tried to order some French wine. And the sommelier suggested that they try a wine from a region called Napa. And my parents, even though we were in San Francisco, lived in Colorado at the time. And the sommelier said, if you don't care for this, we'll take it back and we'll take it off your bill. So with nothing to lose, my parents tried it. And they enjoyed it, and they realized, geez, maybe this can be done in California.
Because they were truly trying to think about moving to France because they loved it so much. They wanted to build their own or be a part of a vineyard and chateau, but it certainly was out of reach at that time. And here they had an opportunity. We can do this here.
Well, it was, yes, it was out of reach for a strange reason. There are all kinds of laws in France about foreign ownership and doing business in a foreign country is never easy, especially then. And so there were some roadblocks in their way, but they hadn't given up on their dream, and they were still very France-centric in the pursuit of that. But that moment, their point of view changed, and then it became one of, geez, maybe this can be done in our own country. And so they thought maybe rather than bringing the Jordans to France, bring the France to Sonoma.
Right. Well, they sure brought France to Sonoma with this chateau. In 72, they found this piece of land, and the day they signed the deed, you were born.
That's right. The day I was born, that's when they signed the deed for most of the parcels on which Jordan sits today.
So the destiny that ended up becoming yours in 2005 had begun that day.
It certainly did, but it was a circuitous route because I didn't go to winemaking school. I'm not a vintner by training. My professional areas of expertise are in other areas, and I really never thought that I would actually ever do this.
Yeah, I noticed you had a respectable career in the Navy Reserves. you practiced law, but you did get that economics degree, so that certainly must have helped out a little bit.
It did. I got my economics degree in undergrad, and then got my law degree and MBA and practiced law and enjoyed a career, a naval career.
Yeah, you weren't one of those that stuck around after you got out of school and helped out with the winery. You moved on, like a lot of kids do from vintners. But were you just not really sure if you'd come back or not?
Well, no, I just never saw my future in the wine business. My parents' primary business at that time was the oil business. And they built the winery and enjoyed that. And then, you know, I went off to boarding school for high school and then college after that. So I wasn't really around. I was off pursuing my own interests really from the ninth grade, essentially, on.
So you didn't really grow up here at this chateau?
Not really. I would come back and be around it. I think I, you know, probably snuck some wine out of the wine cellar in my teenage years from time to time, but it wasn't really part of my identity until I was in my 30s.
The first question that came to mind when I was looking at the website and spending some time with it was, how the heck were they able to get Andrei Chelyshev to be the consultant? To get him on board was an amazing feat for them.
Well, this is a funny story. My parents are divorced in the early 90s, but they are actually very, very close friends. And my mom comes up here to visit. And when you talk about this with my parents, as is often the case with divorced couples, no matter how close they are, how that happened depends upon who's telling the story, whether it's mom's telling the story or dad's telling the story. I'm more familiar with my mom's version, and I know kind of which version I believe. My dad is a brilliant mad scientist type and a unbelievably sweet guy, but he's very shy. And my mom is kind of the bull in the china shop, go get her, nail it down, whatever it takes, you know, damn the torpedoes type. It's not what you'd think with mom gender roles, but I tend to believe it was my mom's version of the story is that my mom basically stalked him and captured him with a butterfly net, I think is kind of what happened. Yeah, I think my mom, and given how relentless she is, pursued him and talked him into it.
Wow. And then interestingly, at the same time, or just shortly thereafter, they had already secured an executive chef for the chateau, which wasn't built yet. That just shows from the very beginning, they had this idea of hospitality and offering the public and fans of the winery that were to come an incredible experience.
Well, that devolves precisely from how my parents came to love wine. My parents came to love wine by virtue of it being enjoyed alongside food. And what better way to showcase your wine, especially one with a style like Jordan, which emphasizes restraint in the cellar, fruit expression. Rob can explain this far better than I can, than to showcase it alongside food. So often, especially in the last 15 years, people look at wines as whether it's, you know, whether they taste them alongside 100 other wines, and that's how they're judged. But that's not how wine is enjoyed. Wine is enjoyed in the context of a good meal. The nicer the wine tends to be nicer, the nicer the meal. And so what better way to tell that story than to do so not only in the context of a well-prepared food so that chefs, sommeliers, the home cook can see how Jordan will interact with their creations, but also to do so in a place as lovely as Sonoma.
Your parents did not skimp at all when they built this place. And my gosh, it is just, it's a marvel. It is one of a kind here in Sonoma County.
Well, like any other business, especially the Jordan is a living thing, and it's made up of all of the people who continue to perfect their crafts here every day. Even though the personnel are different, entirely different pretty much from the early days, the spirit is the same and the goals remain the same. And that is to bring pleasure to people and to do so in a way that it's not just about Jordan wine. It's about how our products can enhance the work of the chef. And whether it be the home cook or whether it be the chef in a fabulous restaurant, our job is to bring pleasure to people, but in concert with other people's artwork.
Jordan has a more recent history of opening their winery to the public with a variety of food-related experiences, vineyard hikes, and for the first time, a Chateau Blanc Cabernet Sauvignon vineyard tasting experience, which also includes a glass of Chardonnay as guests walk through the new Hilltop Vineyard. There you'll enjoy three Jordan Cabernets and charcuterie from the local Journeyman Meat Company. That begins in June, and their first Bastille Day brunch celebration features a lavish buffet and food pairings with Justin's culinary staff. Their Champagne by A.R. Lenoble will also be served. Find out about all the experiences they have to offer at jordanwinery.com and click events. Much of this has to do with the arrival and the many changes incorporated by John Jordan. When you came on in 2005, you changed some things around and also brought sustainability to the property.
We changed a lot of things in 2005. My parents had laid a terrific foundation, but times change. Consumer tastes change, the cultural mores of the time change, and you need to adapt with it. Beginning with our goals on sustainability, recycling wastewater. We're pretty much all solar powered now. Recycling, I mean, a whole number of small initiatives. It's just Jordan doing its part to make the world a better place. And that includes the foundation and other things we do. I mean, businesses don't exist in a vacuum in the 21st century. We are part of society. Whether it's a big business or small business, you have to do your part. And being responsible socially is something that we take very seriously. It's a defining value for us. We had to adapt to use of social media, how wine consumers absorb information, how they learn about wine has mechanically changed fundamentally since the early 80s. When my parents started the winery, there was only, you know, two or three wine magazines and a few wine writers in various papers around the country, and that's how people learned about it. Now the media in a lot of ways is being bypassed, so you have to, even though I'm on a radio program right now, you have to communicate directly with consumers. What's different, what's new, what's exciting, and tell our story about how our passion for constantly improving. So many wineries have become corporate owned in the last 25 years that the family owned wineries are kind of becoming a thing of the past, but it also allows us to be more nimble and a little bit more authentic in our storytelling.
And Lisa does a great job as your marketing director, and your social media presence has been in the forefront for quite a while.
We have a lot of fun doing it. It rings true, I suppose, because the fun in our social media posts, whether it's our videos or the various activities that we do here at the winery that we like to share with our friends, we have great passion for what we do. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, we're having a lot of fun at work. So why should we keep all that fun to ourselves? I mean, that's really how we look at it.
You mentioned your radio show, and I forgot that you were doing that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I do commentary. My background is in national security affairs, economics, and a number of other things. So I'm a commentator on networks throughout the world. I'm multilingual, so I do German, Russian television, Fox News, CNN International, commentating on, you know, on these complicated times. Like tonight, for example, I'm part of the coverage for the Hanoi Summit.
Do you have a podcast or something that you do on a regular basis?
No, I have a TV studio and set here right off my office, so I can just go in, I throw on half a suit just from the waist up and wear my little bare fuzzy slippers underneath because they can't see that on TV, and do whatever topics I'm supposed to do, everything from Venezuela, the federal budget, to arms control and disarmament.
In comfortable fuzzy shoes, and people will have that image from now on.
Count on it. If you're going to be watching the Fox News, the Hanoi coverage tonight, I'll be wearing my bear slippers.
Those are some tough subjects too right now. Goodness gracious.
It's complicated. What I enjoy about it is taking these complicated subjects and trying to boil it down without being an advocate for one side or the other, and explaining what is happening, and what could happen if X happens, then Y may happen, to give the viewer a sense of not only that this is important, but what could happen and how this may relate to them.
Getting back to the winery, it's a much more appealing subject matter. You're always, again, raising the bar. And I mean, if anybody walked into this place, they'd think it was gorgeous. But I understand you just recently redesigned this dining room.
Yes, we're always trying to raise the bar, not only from the winemaking point of view, which is obviously front and center, but in all of the other areas that we do. Because for us, wine is not just a beverage. It's not just some fermented grape juice and some glass. It's an experience. And that's something that's really being lost in today's corporatized, over-marketed wine industry. So we're always looking for experiences here on the property that we can share with guests. And we have our various tours and tastings, and we're always trying to tweak those and freshen them up so that people that come back two or three times are always surprised with something new. This isn't a huge part of our business model, but it's a huge part of who we are, and we put a lot of effort into it just because we love doing it.
And you always have been. You were probably the leaders in the experience industry.
In 2005, that was when I came, that was something that we really wanted to do. Jordan, prior to that, was kind of closed off, which was maybe a little more appropriate in Sonoma County in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s before Sonoma, Healdsburg became a real destination. But then we realized that there's so many people that are wine tourists that just want to come to Sonoma to see wineries. So we wanted to make ours an experience that would really stand out, and not in a kind of a cocky sort of way, but there's so much more to Sonoma County than just wine tasting rooms, which is what people do when they get here. Everything grows here, and you'll know that when allergy season comes along. But so many of the food that's sourced from some of the great restaurants around this country come from here. We have a chef's garden. So we wanted to get people outdoors and really share not only our wines, but provide context for it. And Sonoma is such a wonderful place to live that we wanted to kind of share that too.
Yeah. And you're working on a new experience for this summer with this vineyard right outside the door here, giving them a chance to walk through the vineyard with a glass of wine, sit down and enjoy a really nice wine and food pairing.
Yes, we just planted a vineyard block right across from the winery, walking distance from the main chateau itself. And so we have an experience we'll be offering from June through October, where you can, with a glass of Cabernet, you can walk through a vineyard, and if depending what time of year you'll be coming, you'll be seeing the various stages of the vineyards, from everything from through bud break all the way through harvest. And there's a lot to see. Vineyards are dynamic places. No other plant really does this, but you know, looking outside my house, which is on the ranch, you see right now the vineyards are just like sticks. And 2 months from now, they're gonna be green. 9 months from now, they're just gonna be sticks again. And there's so much that goes into this, and so much of the character and what separates really great wine from just so-so wine happens in the vineyard. And it's, people pay attention to what happens in the cellar and the cooperage and all that. And that's all very important, but it doesn't happen without correct farming in the correct terroir. So when you come, if you were to come and sample this particular experience of ours, along with our estate tour, you get to really experience this half of the wine business that you don't actually see when you just go to a tasting room.
I have not done the estate tour, but that also sounds pretty incredible.
Well, the estate tour was something we did, started in 2013, and that was predicated on the idea we wanted to get people outside in Sonoma County. So we designed a half-day movable feast where it's various food and wine pairings at different parts of the chateau, whether it's in the chef's garden or by the lake or on our vista point. I don't want to give that away, but it is the only spot we could find in the wine country where you can see three appellations while standing on the same hill. Because again, Sonoma is not, the beauty of Sonoma cannot be overstated.
That point you were just talking about where you can see the three appellations, is that the one that has the distance sign to
yes,
Bordeaux, Colorado, Hawaii?
We have a little sign there. It's kind of fun to take pictures on. That sign was my idea of all the different places that mean something to me personally and to the history of Jordan. Little sign that points to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Hawaii, where I go a lot, Colorado, where the winery was actually conceived,
yeah.
And of course the local town, Healdsburg. It's kind of fun. I mean, my friends enjoy taking pictures next to the sign where you can see Mount St. Helena in the background.
It is a great sign, and it almost looks fake, you know, because it's so high up.
It does look fake. I mean, I have like pictures of my friends. It looks really fake, but it isn't.
And so if people are wandering around, they might see you out on the lake doing a little fishing, possibly?
They might see me out on the lake. I'm here at the winery, you know, when I'm in town 7 days a week, really. My office is here. My home is, you know, not even 1,000 yards away. So I'm here all the time. You might see me. I have my Denver Broncos cup with Diet Pepsi, always filled to the brim. But I, you know, I'm here. This isn't a run out of New York or Paris. This is just run by us here in Healdsburg.
I hear that's how you like to keep your relationship with your employees here, is just to be wandering around and just chatting with them and talking. And so you put a lot of foot mileage around here, don't you?
I do. I get my pedometer, I get like an average of 11,000 steps a day just during a work day. Because, you know, it's no fun to try to run a company from your office. It's more fun to go be out with everybody who's pursuing all these crafts. Now, you might think a winery is a small, simple business. And our winery, in the big scheme of things, is a small business. But it's not simple. And here's why. There are so many different crafts that are pursued here every day. In the kitchens, there's the culinary staff. There's the hospitality staff that oversees the guest suites and guest experiences. There's our guest services staff that oversees the tours and tastings. There is obviously the winemaking and enological team. There is the ranch manager, the ranch crew that oversees the gardens, the vineyards, and all of the animals that we have here, because we have it's also kind of a small, but growing rapidly, animal sanctuary. As well as, you know, all the traditional core business functions, you know, IT, accounting. And then you have Lisa's video shop. And if you check out on jordanwinery.com and our blog, you'll see a lot of our fun, some fun and some serious and, you know, what we hope informative material that shares not only just about Jordan and our passion for what we do, but for the history of winemaking and all that goes into it.
Yeah, it's one of the most packed websites I think I've seen of any winery.
Well, we like to think there's something for everybody. Again, it's just, it's think of it more as an outlet for all of our creativity and our passion for it, because we want to share it. Yeah. Because, I mean, this stuff is to be shared. It's not to be hoarded.
We've talked about a few things going on here. Anything planned for the near future that hasn't been discussed yet?
We got a few secret things that we're working on. Nothing we're ready to talk about yet, but there's always something, right? Guaranteed, there's always some new project and generally involves construction of some sort. I do love building things. The dining room is our latest creation. We're still putting the finishing touches on that. This year, we're about to launch our 2015 Cabernet in the next couple of months, and that is the first vintage, which is aged 100% in new French oak. We're really excited about that. Rob Davis, our winemaker, speaks more eloquently on that topic than I ever could. But yeah, we're always looking for some things, some tweaks for some new experiences, and we got some things coming that you'll like.
Yeah, we'll hear from Rob next, and yeah, he is so thorough in his explanation of what he's doing and his past, and it's going to be an interesting listen. John, thanks so much for your time. I know you need to get out of here, but really appreciate it. Nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Jordan's tasting experiences start at just $35. It's a very reasonable fee considering what you get to taste and where you're tasting it. The chateau and grounds are a sight to see. Find all they have to offer at jordanwinery.com. As you heard, coming up next is my conversation with winemaker Rob Davis as we continue on the wine road. We're back on the wine road at Jordan Vineyard and Winery. When I recorded the interviews that morning, I actually started with winemaker Rob Davis. Sitting in front of me on the table in their gorgeous French-adorned dining room was their 2016 Russian River Valley Chardonnay and a 2013, 14, and 15 Alexander Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. Ready for tasting and the backstory on those wines. I don't remember how it came about, but before the interview, the topic of Major League Baseball's spring training came up. I started recording at that time. Then the conversation just kind of took a life of its own. I never really got to my questions. So pull up a chair and join us at the table as Rob shares his winemaking history at Jordan.
We could have tasted the 2005, which was kind of a signature vintage for me because, like I think I mentioned, I was only going to work 6 weeks which 6 weeks was a harvest. You know, I just want to work the harvest. And then I met Andre Chelchev and just, you know, everything just spun the right way. And working for a family and particularly at the time, really focusing on just one wine and the later two wines, but the whole French inspiration just appealed to me so much. And as well with Andre, you know, because Andre, you know, he was working at the Pasteur Institute in 37 when George Latour had him come to California and, you know, start making wine, and his mind not just correct the errors of winemaking at the time at Beaulieu, but also for California, which I think was pretty bright for him to understand that for wine to sell, everybody started having to be making wine. So here's this guy of all this experience, but particularly his European background, his European palate, and Tom Jordan particularly gravitating toward Bordeaux, and then certainly with the Chardonnay, with Burgundy. That was our, we're not trying to copy, but we're inspired by the direction they go. And what that means is that every winemaker talks about balance and balance is so subjective, as our whole business is, but how do you define balance? And in terms of what Tom Jordan defines balance is drinkability. And that's what Andre, I think, mirrored, is that regardless of the age of the wine, a balanced wine will always taste better than wine, that you're waiting for those inequities so in the wine to start balancing each other out.
I was going to ask you, because you talk about silky tannins, or the website does.
Yes.
And I know, like in France, a lot of their wines are so tannic.
Yeah.
You have to wait for them to age.
That was an older style, and I think they've changed some of that. I think Michel Roland has directed some of the winemaking preferences to still really concentrated wines, where
they must be inspired by our ability to sell the wines and have them drink
a well. Right away. But I will say that without exception, and I will say without exception, because I have yet to see somebody taste a wines from Europe and say, "Oh, these are very typical Napa Valley" or something. They almost always their comment is, "Wow," because they've been tasting around, you know, throughout Napa and some of the top properties around here, and they said, "This wine, this is the first wine we tasted that tastes like our wine, you know, like a Bordeaux." And I said, "Well, that's purposeful." Or when the Master Sommeliers, when we entertain a lot here, because, you know, so much of our market is directed toward restaurants, and our Chardonnay, they, you know, these are, as they tell me, this is, you know, we're very proud of where, you know, especially Master Sommeliers are working at restaurants, and then we have this huge list, and then, you know, somebody would bring me a wine and say, you know, "What do you think this is?" And he says, "You know, your Chardonnay just really pisses me off." And I said, "Oh my God," because all winemakers' hearts on their sleeve. And for the wine, "What? You know, you didn't like our wine?" He goes, no. He says, we don't think it's the Chardonnay in California. We always think it's a Pouligny. You know, most of the time we that's a Pouligny, and, you know, it's from this property. And I went, "That's, you know, kind of what we're trying to do in terms of."
What a compliment.
Yeah, because, you know, and they said, "Well, there's not overriding amount of malolactic, the buttery character." You know, it's kind of, I always say it's kind of peering behind the corner, you know. It's not supposed to be obvious. It's supposed to be the little bit of touch of it, which, you know, because the little malolactic adds the mid-palate to our wine and some of the finish, a little creaminess along with the Surly character. So we incorporate a lot of that philosophy that I think Burgundy does, where you're not picking really late. We don't have the limestone soils, which I wish we had. The only limestones in California around the Los Olivos area, Paso Robles area, but that's hot, you know. And I remember when...
That's true. Yeah.
I was really trained by Andre. Terroir, terroir, terroir. Match the climate with the cultivar, with the soil. And last was husbandry. And Tom Jordan felt that certainly climate matched the cultivar for Cabernet, which I think he's definitely correct with Alexander Valley, but he thought husbandry outplayed everything. So ownership control of the vineyard dictated more so than the cultivar. And I was, thank God for Judy Jordan, when she had started the J Project, she went to appropriately an area that was known for sparkling wine, grapes, and that was Russian River. And so when she had an excess in 87, and the whole time I'm telling Tom, "I think we're in the wrong area." So is Andre. And he's, no, ownership's control important, because look at the Premier Grand Cru, look at the first grows. They own and control their own vineyard. And I said, "That's true."
Right.
But they're also, and get this amazing soil. And I finally convinced Tom Jordan that we need the shift from Alexander Valley Chardonnay to Rush River. And we started changing our malolactic, where we went from 100% to almost, I mean, less than 20% now. It's really by taste, it's just a little bit. And then the oak shifted as well, where we didn't want to use a lot of oak. And we really started identifying ourselves palate-wise with our wine with Burgundy. And then it was, okay, what kind of Burgundy do you like? Do you like Meursault? Do you like Pouligny? Do you like Montrachet? And I love the Pouligny because it's so seductive, you know. Yeah. It's not powerful. It's just, it always finishes last in a tasting. You know, we'll put our counterparts here. I don't want to mention them, but they Chardonnays that do really, really well in sales. And then I'll put like a $300 or $400 bottle of Pouligny, and with our Master Sommeliers and lined up comparatively, the Jordan finishes second to last, and the Pouligny finishes last. And then I said, "Well, this is what they are." And I went, but they didn't spend time with it, and that's the thing, is once you would go to the table and have food with it, and then the Pouligny starts to, that little like a flower opening up, and then they'll look at me and goes, "Wow, this is now I should know this, but you know, when you compare it to those counterparts, and they don't, it's like a, I call it like a date, like It's not a 5-minute date. You don't want to spend the whole evening discovering the personality. What do you do? You know, what's your family like? When do you move? All these different things, but you need time to do that. So that's why I think our style of Chardonnay has done so well. Our alcohols tend to be quite a bit lower, acids quite a bit higher, and it's one of the reasons why they age so well.
I hope you were able to catch what Rob was saying about some sommeliers think that Jordan's Chardonnay is comparable to the French Pouliguenie Montrachet wine in Burgundy, which sells for hundreds of dollars. That's quite a statement. Now we'll cover the 2013, 14, and 15 Cabernets they had available for me to taste. I agreed that the wines are silky, but notice the 2014 was slightly drier and more tannic than the other two.
It is. I think it's because it's. I think it's a, of the three. It's my favorite. It's probably. It's the closest thing for me. I think to a Pauillac.
14 was a.
But it was a powerful year, and the 13. I think there was more fruit intensity than the 12. The 12 is just. The tannins were so refined, just even from the fermentation we're going through, and I said, you know, this is not going to require much aging for it because the wine is so well balanced. The 13 just showed much more fruit, and the 14 was even more so. It was a bit of a riper year, but we've changed a little bit of the oak format. We used to be 50% American oak and 50% French when we started out.
I was going to ask you about that. I heard you.
Yeah, but the 14, it was a big wine, and this is the challenge that winemaking wise, what we had a decision. We could either, I thought we have a Cy Young winner here, as you suggest, but do you just want to use them for six innings, or you want to use them for all nine? Well, you want to use them for nine. I want to go the distance with this wine because I don't get vintage like this very often.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm working with John, is to be able to get a third year additional, one additional year of bottle age. So instead of 2 to 3 years, and he says, you really think that makes a difference? It's exponentially different. It's not just, you know, linear. It's huge. That third year, John, in the bottles is really amazing. But the 14 really would benefit by that even more with the fifth year. Is that this is a wine I think was as a library wine will be significant when we bring it back out. But with food, put some cheese with it, a good cut of meat, and
it really
the length and breadth of this wine really shows well.
Backing up a bit, one of the changes John agreed to incorporate from the get-go came as great news for Rob.
That was a major shift for us when John Jordan came on. It literally was the first meeting with John. Finally, you know, I kind of broke the silence. I said, well, John, so what do you want to do? And he says, well, what do you mean? I said, well, your father was really, really committed to estate fruit. And I said, as your winemaker, I can make the best Cabernet from our estate, but I can make a far better Cabernet if you allow me to source the fruit. I said, all the years I work with Andre and while my travels to Europe with my friends, talk about terroir, and I got to tell you, we don't have the correct terroir for the best Cabernet we can make. Give me a chance, and I can find better vineyards. And he says, and it was, if I had springs in my butt, I would have made it to the moon. Because when he said, Rob, I don't care about authorship. I just want to make great Cabernet. You find the best fruit you can. I was like, boing! I said, gone. And so we could have tasted the 05, but that was in October when we met, and that 05 really wasn't defined by the changes yet. But then 06, 07, 08, and these wines really show the breeding ground of our much more terroir-based, where they're much red fruit, much more black fruit.
There's been a more recent development. A first for the winery as they continue to focus on making their wine as appealing as it can be. You heard Rob mention they've been using both American and French oak with their barrel program. It's worked well for them. But not long ago, Rob was doing some tasting trials from a variety of coopers, the ones who make the barrels. And during that tasting, he came to a realization.
And so I went to John and said, hey, John, we just had an epiphany here. I was like, I think, you know, we've moved from 50-50 to two-thirds French oak, but I think we need to finally, with the fruit sourcing we're getting now, the kind of tannins we're getting out of our growers, we should go 100% French oak.
Are you using any neutral oak at all?
No, actually, we've responded to the fruit that we're getting from our new and improved vineyards. So we're much more like a first growth, where first growths are almost 50% one-year-old and 50% new. And we just found that we're not trying to make the wine oakier, but we're still responding to the tannins coming from the fruit. So it's the nature of the structure, and again, not taste, but the feel of the wine, because I think we'll always be perceived as a as a popular restaurant wine. You know, Tom, and I think John as well, and certainly our consumers focus a lot on the drinkability and the finesse and the balance of our Cabernet. So that is a major focus for us. So there's tools that we're using, but the newer oak also, I don't perceive, it's not overwhelming in the oak characteristic, but seeing the structure, it works very well.
You can now taste that first vintage aged entirely in French oak, which is the 2015 Jordan Cabernet Sauvignon, just released on May 1st at the price of $57. That's a killer deal for what you're getting. I sure hope you enjoyed this podcast from Jordan Vineyard and Winery and getting to meet CEO John Jordan and winemaker Rob Davis. But I have so much more. Rob and I talked for 90 minutes. Needless to say, only a fraction of it made it into my radio show. So what follows will be part of the outtakes. Much of it is Rob sharing his unforgettable memories with Andrei Chelischev. As you'll hear, he was quite a character. For those of you unfamiliar with Andrei, he's called the Dean of American Winemakers, the Godfather, the Maestro. No other person made a greater impact on the American wine industry than Andrei. 2 years ago, his great-nephew, Mark, produced a film called Andrei, the Voice of Wine. He was a Russian-born viticulturist and winemaker, hired by Beaulieu Vineyards owner George Latour in 1938. So by the time Rob worked with him at Jordan, he'd already spent 38 years in Napa Valley. He also worked and consulted in Sonoma County, even Washington. Since Rob and I were talking baseball when we first met, I compared Rob as the young winemaker fresh out of UC Davis getting to work with Andrei to a college baseball pitcher upon graduation having a Cy Young winning major league pitcher take him under his wing.
Absolutely. That's a great way of looking at it, because I the 4 years at UC Davis were absolutely wonderful, and the professors were the kind of like spring training where they weren't distant. You could go to their house. You could have dinner with them. You could go taste wine with them anytime. You could always go to their office and sit there, and then they'd, fold their legs, and they just love talking about something very complicated. And I love that aspect of it, but they never taught you really how to make wine. They taught you the medium of wine and how it works and the chemistry behind why things work the way it did, but not really how to. We were taught on a 20-point scale, how to describe the wines. And I remember describing the wine to him, and he says, tell me what you think of this wine, And I went through how I was taught by Maynard Amory. And after I finished this very sterile description of it, and I looked at him, and he goes, very French expression, and I said, well, what's wrong with you? He goes, well, your description may be correct, my dear sir, but who would want to drink it? Andrei taught about pleasure. Does the wine either give you pleasure? If it doesn't, what can we do to enhance that, to make it more pleasurable? Whereas UC Davis is well, how can we make this stable? How can we, take care of this to make sure it doesn't blow up in the bottle? And that's I think, the poetry of what our winemaking became. And that's the, so his expressions of all these wines, it would be,
I think it makes it more easy for people to understand.
Yeah.
Do it that way.
Yeah.
I like to describe, I'm a fan of Pinot Noir.
Oh, that was his favorite.
I like to describe Pinot Meunier as the older sister of the girl you're dating, the Pinot Noir.
Yeah, see, that's
and
perfect.
You're enticed by her, and you don't get to see her that often, but every time you do, it grabs your attention.
Yep.
And you're just...
That, and there's... I keep saying, you would love meeting Andrei, because this is it's kind of... That's how we captured a wine, and you would identify with that very much. You would... Nice. Is a very tall blonde with the wind, wisping at her hair, and or this is a brunette, very sturdy, very strong, and we're on a date with her. She's the one that's going to be paying for the meal, those kind of things. Like a nightingale that's found its soul and it just sings all night. It's like, and that's I think that description to me defines the finish of a wine, because that long blonde hair, but it's. The wind is blowing at it, the length of it,
that's true.
How long is it in the mouth? Because he said, it's all the attributes. And he says, always pay attention to the bottle, it's the dress. He says, but then the dress is what attracts you, If it's the label's out of sorts or whatever, then that's not as good to look at. Because I thought, who cares about the label? Who cares about the bottle? It's, oh no, the dress is very important. But then he talked about crayon, the lipstick. And that first taste and how it lays upon the lips and the texture. Because I would, you know, being 22, I just swirl it. I think, slow down, you know, it's just, how does that? And he broke it all down into all the different, I call it hedonic pleasurable senses. And he'll say, the crayon, I know. And I had a little bit of French, and I said, well, I understand the lipstick, but is that really important to the wine? He says, my dear sir, you're a young man. He says, what's the most important thing that happens? What's the first thing that you hope that happens on a date? And I said, gosh, if I just got a kiss. And he goes, yes, the kiss. But what's more important than the first kiss? And I said, so I start thinking about it, and he goes, the second kiss. Because at the first kiss, you don't get in the second kiss, and that's pretty much the end of the day. But you think, oh, the second kiss, you know, because that means everything's going pretty well, and then the romance really blossoms. And that second kiss, that second taste is when all of a sudden that's, then the whole process starts, you know, that you're focusing on the nose, you're focusing on the body, but particularly he said, the most important thing I want is the memory of the wine, is the finish. He said, because everything could be going great, the nose, the palate, but if it's rough, it finishes short, that's what you most remember. And then, of course, when that bottle comes up again, you go, I think I'm going to pass on that. So, yeah, these are just golden
moments.
How
long were you with Andre?
So I met him, I started here September 11th, 1976, and we didn't start the harvest till October 13th of 76. But I met Andre the first week I started here. And, like, my job was to go sample vineyards, but Andre took as well as he did for everybody, I always took a liking to everybody, I said, who in the heck is this guy anyway? And he goes, oh, he's our consultant. And I said, okay. I said, well, you know, I didn't really know what the background. The more I studied, I go, oh, my God.
I'm surprised you didn't hear about him.
No, I didn't. Of course, they didn't tell these things.
He was already a legend by the 70s.
He was. He absolutely was, from 38 to 72 at Beaulieu. And then he died in April 5th of 1994. He was almost 93. He worked all the way up to the, and
Yeah, he upped it like to a week or so before he died.
Yeah, he was in the Queen of the Valley Hospital, and you know, I was very, very close to Andre, and you know, he's like so many figures to me, like a father figure, my best friend. He was my mentor, and so you knew Andre, you thought he was going to live forever. He just had this energy, this precision of defining wine and what you really needed to be working on, but this passion that was just overwhelming, but this energy that was amazing, for it just never seemed to get old. And so I was there, and he was there in the hospital bed, and he says doctor, he says, why the long face? And I said, oh, Andre, I said, I talked to the doctors, and the prognosis is not very good. And he goes, yes, I know. I don't know whether I have 2 months left, 2 weeks left, or even 2 minutes. But we still don't know the right rootstock for Pinot Noir and Carneros. You know, and that was his comment. I went, holy crap. My goodness. And he's right. You know, the shallow sandy soils of the Carneros area needs a different rootstock than the ones they first came up with. But he was his mind was always working.
He had solved that one, yeah.
So, you know, I say I worked 18 years with Andre the whole time. And, you know, I traveled through Europe with Andre, particularly, you know, France. And that was golden. The 3 weeks I spent with Andre, and then I always say that even the trips I took without Andre, I still had Andre with me, because maybe things have not changed that much in the first growth. But, you know, you really, they didn't have tours, you know, to go to Lafitte, Latour, Margaux, Mouton, Aubry, right, and all those. Needed to have a letter of introduction.
Yeah.
And his letter of introduction was a golden key. And I would be like at Aubry and you know, knock on the door, and I'd say, I'm here visiting. I'm here going to be for 2 weeks, and I wanted to be able to taste your wines out of the barrels. And but I, you know, I work at this winery where we're trying to emulate a Bordeaux. Well, I'm sorry, sir, but they're always really accommodating. I really love to do that, but, and I said, well, you know, I got this letter here from Andre Chalice. Why didn't you say so? And then all of a sudden, doors open up, I love going back there. I try to get back there every year. But the friends I have, we just pick up right where we left off, and we're like kids in a sandbox. And so, you know, time after time when I go visit my friends there, and I was visiting one of my last visits to Petrus, I wanted to start taking, because I got to know Jean-Claude Barraway and Christian Oex back in 1980. And we became friends ever since. So I'm saying, I'm going to drop in and see my friend Christian. I go, oh, you have to have a tour. I mean, you have to, they don't take tours, you know, you have to have an appointment. I said, well, I know somebody there, you know, not to brag, but it is. It's a very, very, very small little, very small winery. But I was taking my associate winemaker, Maggie, and I said, you have to taste Petrus, you know, because we can't be buying Petrus every day. But yet, and when we're going through the tanks, and I said, oh, this has a similarity to Petrus in terms of either aroma or the palate, the tannins, whatever. Unless you had that reference point, then, you know, I couldn't really share that with her. And I wouldn't have had it unless I had that experience as well. So we get there, and I've been with other winemakers visiting, particularly European wineries, and they think the answer is all cellar-driven, you know, what yeast do you use, and how long do you, what temperature do you do the fermentation, and how you do your punch downs, you do pump overs, what barrels do you use, and how long the barrels, and how do you treat the barrels, and, you know, the list goes on, but it's all cellar manipulation. And so we get the Petrus, and I just want to taste the wine, and Jean-Claude walks out the vineyard, avoids the whole cellar, you know, because even then, my conversation with him is that, my first visit with him, he had these concrete tanks.
I was wondering about that.
You know, Petrus, for all the money they had, why are you selling for concrete tanks? And he says, you know, the temperature variations and the control of the fermentation just seemed to work well for that, you know, between the cap temperature and the juicing, and you know, all the things he explained. And I said, so then I went to Latour, and they had all stainless steel. And stainless steel was kind of, the salesman for stainless steel tanks was doing it, making a lot of money, but people were converting from wood or concrete to stainless steel. And Jean-Claude says, no, I may be old-fashioned, but I really like it. And now concrete is the latest thing, you know, everybody wants to go to concrete. Yeah, but anyway, he avoids that, and we go straight to the vineyard, and he digs his hand in the vineyard soil, and he picks it up, and he goes, this is all you need to know about Petrus. And I was looking at, yes, that's exactly, that's the whole storyline of what we're doing here. Is the terroir. And if you look at the geology of Pomerol, and then you see Petrus, it's this very specific soil. It's like almost like the hole of a donut. And that's where Petrus is. And it's very unique compared to everything else. And that's where it's, they're obviously very proud of that. But one of the reasons why I think Petrus is so unique. So all these lessons that when I travel, not as much to California wineries, but my European wineries, it's terroir, terroir, terroir. But all this I learned through Andre, tasting with him, maybe a power suggestion, but time after time after time after time again, when we looked at soils and then tasted the wine, there was that fingerprint that was so important.
What profound memories Rob has, and to have such a life-changing opportunity. And I bet those stories were informative for you aspiring young winemakers. Needless to say, all those experiences and knowledge can be tasted in Jordan's wine. If you ever get a chance, visit the Chateau in Alexander Valley, outside of Healdsburg in Sonoma County. Jordan Vineyard and Winery. I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time on The Wine Road.